with salmon colonization, perhaps we should take a look at a colonization event right from the get-go, right from the very beginning. So before I kind of dive into my focus research site and my study questions, I want to set up just a general conceptual model about how we might think about colonization in salmon and perhaps even other species. So I'm going to talk about two alternative hypotheses, one of which I'll call self-sustaining, and the other one I'll call the sink hypothesis. So in the very beginning, at the first generation, all the colonists that move into some new habitat, with the new habitat being over here, have to come from some source population, right? There has to be some source of colonists to donate into this new area. Now, in the long term, for this new population to become established, at some point, those colonists in the new habitat have to produce recruits or fish that were produced in the new habitat, and then they themselves return to spawn in the new habitat. Now, if the population becomes self-sustaining, the production in the new habitat, over time, will compose a greater and greater proportion of the population. So I'm showing these recruits, or the fish that were produced in the new habitat, in red. And I'm contrasting those with strays, or colonists coming to the new habitat from some distant source population. And those I'm showing in blue. Now, alternatively, the new habitat could be a sink. And in this situation, again, in that first generation, all these colonists have to come from some source population. But over time, they're not able to produce a significant number of returning recruits, such that even by the third generation, the population of the new habitat is still dominated by strays from the source population. And I don't necessarily think of these two alternatives as mutually exclusive. And rather, there's probably a continuum here at some point. But I think this is a useful exercise just to give you some of the basic concepts that I'll talk about for the rest of the talk today. Okay. So with that, I want to introduce the Cedar River, Washington, which is where I've done my research for the last 6 years. So the Cedar flows west from the Cascade Mountains and down into the south end of Lake Washington. And then it's connected to Puget Sound and the ocean via a shipping canal through the heart of Seattle. And in 1901... the city of Seattle built Landsberg Diversion Dam right here. And this dam still supplies the majority of Seattle residents with their drinking water. But since its construction, this dam had blocked salmon from going upriver. Until 2003, when Seattle Public Utilities, as the cornerstone of an elaborate fish passage project, well, a elaborate habitat conservation plan, built a fish ladder designed to give Chinook and coho salmon and steelhead trout access to this area above the dam. And so if you've been to Ballard, this is pretty much similar to the Ballard locks, where the fish are swimming into this ladder and accessing the new habitat on their own power. So really what this structure did was simply open the door to salmon and allow them to move in and naturally recolonize this habitat on their own. So in addition to providing a really unique opportunity to study the colonization from the very first generation, the fish ladder provides a great and handy platform to sample fish. So we basically get our hands on all the fish as they enter the new habitat, and we're able to take a host of measurements, and that'll be the focus of my research that I'll talk about today. So once these salmon ascend the area above the dam, so the dam is down here, they have access to about 32 kilometers of habitat in the river above the dam. So this is both in the main stem Cedar River, but also some tributaries, and I've shown areas that are off-limits to salmon in this dashed line. And these are basically just areas above waterfalls that are the salmon can't get up. And so there's two points I want to make here, and the first is that there actually exists a likely source population for both Chinook and coho salmon, the species that I'll talk about primarily today, below the dam. So there's naturally spawning populations in the Cedar River below the dam. So the dam is about river kilometer 35, so there's quite a range of habitat below the dam, and this potentially would provide a source of colonists for the population expansion. And the second point is that the quality of the habitat above the dam is actually quite high. The city of Seattle has gradually acquired ownership of the land over the last 100 years, and they manage this area as a reserve. So it's completely off limits to development, recreation, logging, anything like that. So in terms of the habitat quality, it's actually quite high. Okay, so this brings me to my research question. And so the basic question here is, how successful are the colonizing Chinook and coho salmon as they access this new habitat in the Cedar River? So to answer this question, I'm going to divide it into two broad topics. The first, I'm going to talk about population productivity and how productive is the whole population. And the second topic, I'm going to talk about individual reproductive success. So which individual salmon are the most productive in terms of producing returning adult salmon? And so I'm going to focus on two traits. In Chinook salmon, I'm going to talk about natural origin versus hatchery Chinook salmon. And in coho salmon, I'm going to talk about breeding date, with the basic question being, are salmon that spawn early, in the middle, or late more successful at producing returning adult offspring? So this graph here simply shows the number of salmon that have gone up the ladder over the first 6 years of the study. So again, I want to emphasize that none of these fish were captured or transplanted, that these fish entered this ladder on their own volition. So the height of the bar shows roughly the number of fish, and the proportion of the bar that's black shows the proportion of the fish going up the ladder that were males. So we see that over time there's been a slow and somewhat steady increase for both species, although there's kind of some ups and downs. The other point here is that especially with the Chinook early on, the sex ratio was really skewed in that there were many more males than females. And that'll come back again later in the talk, so keep that in mind. So more males than females. Now, unfortunately, just this raw count of fish doesn't allow me to differentiate between those two alternative hypotheses I showed you in that conceptual model. So I can't really say whether the population becomes self-sustaining or not until I take a closer look at the population and try to identify those strays and the recruits. So how am I going to do that? Now, in terms of the methods, there's kind of three basic steps. So the first is that we collect tissue samples from all the fish as they ascend the fish ladder. And here I want to acknowledge my collaborators from the City of Seattle, Paul Folds and John McDowell, who have collected all the samples and taken all the data for the last 6 years. So they've done a lot of work to help me out here. So in addition to collecting a tissue sample, we also look for the presence or absence of an adipose fin. So this is a small fin on the dorsal side of the animal, and hatcheries in the area, upon releasing juvenile hatchery fish, will clip that adipose fin as an external mark to indicate that that fish was produced in a hatchery. So we check for the presence or absence of that fin. We take a tissue sample. And those tissue samples I bring into the lab here at the University of Washington. We extract DNA, and then we genotype each of the fish at a set of 10 microsatellite DNA markers. And again, here I've had a lot of help, especially a fellow named Will Atlas, who's now a graduate student at Simon Fraser University, and he has been instrumental in running these samples over the last couple years. And then the final step is that we use these genotypes to assign parentage. So I can take a look at a pool of potential offspring and try to match them up to parents. And just to convince you that this is actually quite simple in concept, that there's no kind of genetic hocus pocus going on here, I just want to like lay out exactly what I'm doing. So we've got potential parents here, a spawning male and a spawning female, and the genetic variation that I'm measuring is along this x-axis here, and the position of these peaks and these numbers basically represents the genotype or the score that we assign each animal. So we genotype the parents, and then we genotype the potential offspring, and then just like you learned about in freshman biology with Gregor Mendel and his pea plants, each offspring inherits one of these scores or one of these alleles from each parent. And by genotyping all the parents, genotyping all the offspring, at a set of markers, more than just one that I've shown here, you're able to actually assign parentage. Okay. So here I just want to describe my general approach to parentage. The Chinook salmon mature at ages 2 to 5, and this table shows in blue the return years that were considered as parents for each of the offspring return years to the left. So I only consider natural origin fish as offspring, basically because if the fish had a clipped adipose fin, it was clearly not going to assign parentage to any fish in my sample because it was produced in the hatchery. So in the parentage program, each parent was stripped of all of its phenotype information. And when I say phenotype, I mean the sex, either male or female, and the year that it returned. And I only use the genotypes to make the assignments. My reason was that Comparing the phenotypes, the sex and the year, of matched parents from the genetic assignments would provide a separate and independent check of the quality of the assignments. So, for example, for Chinook salmon returning in 2008, I considered all fish that ascended the ladder in 2003, 4, 5, and 6, regardless of their sex, as potential parents. And then I go back and look at the assignments that match two parents, and I'm looking to see if they're assigning one male and one female, both from the same year. If they assign, say, two males or two fish from different years, that indicates to me that my assignments would be off, that there'd be some problem with the parentage. Now, in practice, it worked out pretty well because less than 5% of the assignments match parents of the same sex or from different years. And basically, I did the same exact thing with the coho salmon. So the coho mature at ages 2 to 3. So I have a slightly smaller set of parents for each return brood. But again, the error rate was quite low. So this gives me a great deal of confidence that the assignments are doing what I think they're doing. So for Chinook, I actually had one complete brood. So those would be the fish that spawned in 2003. And their five-year-old offspring would have returned in 2008. Now for this analysis, I also considered one partial brood. And those would be the fish that spawned in 2004. So their four-year-old offspring returned in 2008. The five-year-olds are actually returning right now in 2009. I haven't included those samples yet. So I've got one complete and one partial brood for Chinook salmon. Now for coho, they mature at ages 2 to 3, and so I actually have three complete broods. Fish that spawned in 2003, 2004, and 2005. So this table just shows the parentage assignments that I made for return years on the left here. So for Chinook returning in 2005 through 2008, this is simply the number of fish that I analyzed, acquired genotypes for, and then I've got the number that I assigned no parents, and then one parent in the middle here, either a dad only or a mom only, and then the fish to whom I assigned two parents. Now, I use these parentage assignments to classify. I use these the parentage assignments to classify fish into two different categories. So the fish that I assigned no parents to, I term those strays, and those basically because they had no parents to whom I sampled in a previous year. Because they had no parents to whom I sampled in a previous year, I'm quite confident that they were not produced above the dam. Now, on the other hand, the fish to whom I assigned two parents, I'm terming those the recruits, because those are fish that, based on the parentage assignment, there's strong evidence that they were spawned above the dam. Now, in the middle, I've got these fish to whom I assigned one parent. And these are a little more tricky. One parent assignments could result from a number of different sources. There could have been problems with the genotyping and the parentage. There could have been perhaps fish that snuck up river without being sampled. Some of the fish that are assigning one parent, perhaps the fish went up river, milled around for maybe just a day or two, and then later dropped back down below the dam and spawned with a fish to whom I didn't sample. So there's a number of different sources that these fish could have cropped up for, but the bottom line is at this point I'm not sure exactly how to treat them, so I'm going to just put those in an uncertain category and kind of shove them off to the side. Okay, so with that information, I'm able to put together a graph that looks like this, that really decomposes each year's return year, each year's run, into fish originating from a number of different sources. Okay, so this is a very colorful, a lot going on here, but I'll try to walk you through it slowly. So in each return year, there's three columns. And the column on the far left, all these guys, are all the strays. Now, the strays are coming from two different sources. There's the strays that have the clipped adipose fins that we know come from the hatchery, and I've shown those in light blue. And then there's the strays to whom had intact adipose fins. We know they were produced naturally, but they did not assign any parentage. So no parents were assigned. They were produced somewhere, but it wasn't the cedar. It wasn't the river above the dam. Now, in the middle column, I've got the recruits. And so these are fish that I assigned two parents to from a previous year, and the color, either red, black, green, or yellow, indicates the year that they were produced. So for example, this black bar here, these fish returning in 2006 are three-year-old Chinook salmon that were produced, or I'm sorry, these are two-year-old Chinook salmon produced by the 2004 spawners. And here you've got the three-year-old Chinook salmon produced by those same 2004 spawners.
And here you've got the four-year-old Chinook salmon produced by those same 2004 spawners. And again, on the right, this white box here, are those are the one parentage assignments, the group that I'm uncertain about. So what we see, when we look at the whole picture, initially, obviously, all the fish entering the new habitat are strays. This area had been off limits for over 100 years. These fish are colonizing this new habitat from some source population. But over time, we're starting to see a little bit of production from the fish that actually spawned above the dam. Although, by 2008, the population is still mostly strays. Although I'd point out that for the first time in 2008, you had the total natural production above the dam outnumbered the hatchery strays, shown here in light blue. Okay, so I'm going to move on and basically just do the exact same thing with coho salmon. So this is the same exact table, just different numbers. So we've got the return year for the coho here, the number that I analyzed, the number I assigned no parents, the number I assigned one parent, and then again the number I assigned two parents. And again, I use these parentage assignments to classify the fish as strays and recruits. And we plot this for coho salmon, we see something that's really quite a bit different from the Chinook. So, first of all, again, we've got the strays over here on this left blue column. And if you notice, virtually all the strays were naturally produced, and only a very small number were originated from the hatchery. If you look at the natural production in this middle bar, you can see that even by 2006, the recruits that were produced above the dam are almost equal in number to the strays entering the habitat from some other source population. By 2007, the recruits, primarily from the 2004 generation, these are three-year-olds plus some two-year-olds from 2005, are vastly outnumbering the strays. And again, in 2008, most of the fish ascending the fish ladder were produced above the dam. So this is quite different from the Chinook. If you remember, the Chinook were mostly strays out here in 2008. And I think this is not so surprising if you consider that the generation time for Chinook salmon is much less. They're maturing at ages 2 to 3, whereas the Chinook are maturing at ages 2 to 5. It makes sense that the population would be moving towards becoming self-sustaining earlier in time. So now I want to talk about population productivity. And so to do this, I'm going to use a statistic that we like in fisheries called recruits per spawner. So recruits per spawner is the number of returning adult fish produced by a given number of spawners. So a value of 1 indicates replacement. So that means for each fish that went up the fish ladder, one more would have come back in subsequent years. So if the value is above 1, the population is expanding. If the value is below 1, the population is contracting, or it's not replacing itself. Now, to do this analysis, I only considered the females, because females are the sex that's going to limit the spatial and numerical expansion of the population. The females carry a limited number of eggs, whereas the males are carrying virtually unlimited supply of sperm. So I looked to see how many returning adult females were produced by a given number of females in the early years. So for Chinook, 16 females went up the fish ladder in 2003, and the value here, less than 1, indicates that only about 8 returned in subsequent years. Now, in 2004, the value of this recruits per spawner statistic was above 1, indicating the population was just barely replacing itself and, in fact, expanding just a little bit. Now, for coho salmon, all these values are above 1, including, well, 2 of these were almost 2, which means a value of 2 would mean that the population basically doubled in one generation. So what this indicates, particularly for the coho salmon, is that the population is already self-sustaining. It's supporting itself with its own production above the dam. Now, I want to point out that these numbers are really minimum estimates, because there's a number of fish that potentially are recruits that I'm not counting in this total here. First of all, salmon that were produced above the dam, but they themselves don't quite make it back to the dam and perhaps spawn in the lower river, would not be included because they weren't sampled as they ascended the fish ladder. Okay? I'm going to talk a little bit more about that on the next slide. If you remember from this 2004 brood year from Chinook, I don't have the five-year-olds, so any five-year-olds that are returning now in 2009 would only serve to increase those numbers. And we're not including any salmon that are harvested by recreational, commercial, or tribal fisheries. So I wanted to take a look and see if there was potentially a spillover effect whereby fish that were produced, or the production above the dam was serving to increase abundances of fish below the dam. So this was that situation I mentioned just previously where perhaps the fish was spawned above the dam but didn't return all the way to the dam to spawn itself, but was spawned in the lower river and wasn't included in my counts. So with the help of some folks from the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, I acquired a number of scale samples from these the carcass surveys that these guys do in the lower river. I had a very limited number of them, only 31. And most of them didn't assign any parents. They looked like they were probably produced in the lower river. But one of the 31 actually did assign two parents, indicating that it was spawned above the dam. So I realize this is a small sample, but when you consider that the run size for this year was approximately 1,000 fish in the lower river, I think you think about scaling up this one out of 30 fish, there's a potential for there to be a small but not insignificant increase in abundance in the lower river from the production above the dam. Okay, so I'm going to switch gears now, and we're going to talk about individual reproductive success. And to do that, I want to talk about the sex roles in salmon spawning. And this video was shot by a colleague of mine up at Seattle Public Utilities, I think really helps illustrate some of the points I want to make. So we've got the female here. You see how she turns on her side and digs? She's excavating a little pit into which she's going to deposit her fertilized embryo. So you can see the nest that she's making for herself. It's kind of that lighter colored area. And then here we've got the female in the foreground. Now we're look in the back here. So these are a number of males that are all competing and vying for access to try to get close to her. Now, if you remember from the beginning of the talk, I told you that the sex ratio was really skewed. There's many more males than females. So all these males are competing, trying to get close to the female. So he's zooming around. Usually there'll be one male who's the alpha male, and he'll literally fight off all his competitors, ram them, bite them. The big teeth that you see that salmon have are not for feeding. They're basically for fighting. So there goes the female. She's excavating a small pit in which she's going to deposit her eggs. And the males are basically zooming around trying to get close to her. So the males and the females are competing for different things. The females basically just need to find a suitable spawning site. Now, because the densities are really low, and because we're kind of in these colonization conditions, there's a range of suitable spawning sites. There doesn't seem like to be a great deal between the females in terms of competition for these spawning sites. Now, the males, on the other hand, there's a lot of them, and they're competing for a limited number of females. So again, I'm going to talk about individual reproductive success. Which individual salmon were the most productive in terms of producing returning adult offspring? So at this point, when I mention reproductive success, I use that synonymously with the number of adult offspring. So this x-axis shows the number of returning adult offspring produced by a potential spawner. And the y-axis, the height of the bar, is the proportion of fish in that year and that sex that produced that many offspring. So what we see is there's a great amount of variation, particularly amongst the males. So if you look in 2003, just about 3/4 of the males produced no returning adult offspring, but a small number produced a large number of returning offspring. And again in 2004, we see that there's a much higher proportion of the males compared to females produced no returning adult offspring. Now, evolutionary biologists like to use this statistic called the opportunity for selection. And this is really just a standardized metric of the variance in reproductive success. So we take the variance in the number of returning adult offspring and divide that by the mean number of returning adult offspring squared. And what we see, these values over here on the right, is that the value for males vastly exceeds that for the females. And this is a really consistent trend both across years in Chinook and also in the coho salmon that I'll talk about in a minute. So there's much more variation in male reproductive success than female reproductive success. So I'm also going to talk a little bit about the fitness of the hatchery fish compared to the natural origin fish in our Cedar River colonization event going on. Now, there's probably no topic in salmon biology that garners as much debate and controversy as the wild versus hatchery issue. And I'm just going to give kind of a brief intro here and point out a fairly high-profile paper that came out recently in which the authors compared the relative reproductive success of the hatchery fish and divided that, the average reproductive success of the hatchery fish and divided by the average reproductive success of the wild fish. So they had a similar setup that I had. They were sampling steelhead trout, actually, as they were migrating upriver in the Hood River, Oregon. And what they found was that the relative reproductive success of the hatchery fish was less than the wild fish. So the value less than one indicates that the hatchery fish, on average, are producing fewer returning adult offspring than the wild fish. And these authors added some data for some other studies with similar results and claimed that for each generation in captivity, the fitness of the hatchery population is declining. So it seems like a worthwhile question. If this is potentially a concern, we should take a look at this in the Cedar River. So just a little bit of background on the Chinook hatcheries in the region. There's actually no hatchery on the Cedar River itself. There are two hatcheries in the basin. There's a small research and education-oriented facility on the UW campus here, right in Portage Bay. And then the State Department of Fish and Wildlife runs a production-oriented hatchery over on Issaquah Creek. So Issaquah Creek is actually quite far from the Cedar River as the fish swims. Fish would have to migrate in through here up to the north end of Lake Washington, up the Sammamish River, all the way through Lake Sammamish to find Issaquah Creek. Whereas to get to the Cedar River, they're coming into the south end of Lake Washington, and then the Landsberg Dam is situated about right here. So some of my colleagues that work for the city and the county and the state do a series of carcass surveys in the lower river below the dam, and they usually find that on the spawning grounds in the lower river, roughly 10 to 30% of the fish that are spawning naturally were hatchery produced, indicated by clipped adipose fins. So it looks like there's probably some ongoing genetic exchange from the hatcheries onto the river. Now, what this means is that for my test, really all I can do is compare the effects of one generation in the hatchery. So even the fish that were not clipped, that have an intact adipose fin, I don't really know much about their ancestry. They could have been produced by two hatchery fish that spawned naturally. All I know about is the origin of the fish that is ascending the ladder, indicated by the presence or the absence of its adipose fin. Okay. So I compared that same metric. I took the average reproductive success of the hatchery fish and divided that by the average reproductive success of the natural origin fish. And what I found was that for the males, at least, there was a fairly consistent pattern in that the hatchery fish had about 75% of the reproductive success of the natural origin fish. Now, for the females, there was no consistent pattern at all. In fact, one year, the natural origin fish were more productive, and the other year, the hatchery fish were more productive. Now, for all these comparisons, there was so much variation that the statistics were unable to differentiate between the reproductive success of the two groups. Now, just as kind of a closer look of what's going on, I wanted to plot the raw data because I think it gives a little bit closer indication of some of what's going on here. So I want to focus on the males. Males from 2003 and 2004 on the bottom, the natural origin fish in the white, and the hatchery fish in the gray. If you look, for 2003, the median fish, now the median is indicated by this thick black line, was actually the same. The median fish in this year produced zero returning offspring. That means more than half of the males didn't produce any returning adult offspring. Now, the average reproductive success of the natural origin fish was brought up by a few really productive spawners. We see kind of the same thing in 2004. In 2004, the median hatchery fish actually had higher reproductive success than the median natural origin fish, but the average of the natural origin fish was brought up by two very productive spawners. So to my eye, what I see happening here is that there's a lot of variation in the data, and the hatchery and the natural origin fish actually have pretty similar distributions, But the natural origin fish kind of have a higher probability of having a really successful spawner that's going to bring up the average. Okay. I'm going to talk a little bit about coho salmon now, and this is the similar graph that I showed before with the Chinook, where you've got the number of returning adult offspring on the x-axis. You've got the proportion of each sex in, within each sex and year of fish that produce that many offspring. And again, we see pretty much the same trend as I saw in the Chinook. We've got more males than females producing zero returning adult offspring, and you've got most fish producing none or very few offspring, and a small number of fish producing many offspring. And if I calculate this opportunity for selection statistic, again, we see that the value for males is much higher than for females. So there's more variance in the reproductive success of the males than the females. So I also want to talk about the potential effects of breeding date in coho salmon. Now, for a number of reasons, it might be good to be spawning early. So in competition for mates, particularly amongst the males, there's an advantage to prior residence in that it's once you establish a territory, it's harder for an intruder to come in and kick you off your territory. There might also be an advantage for your offspring. If they're able to emerge early and get a head start on growth, they might maintain that head start on growth throughout the growing season. And then we know that survival is dependent on size, so that might give an advantage in terms of survival. But like everything in biology, there's trade-offs. You don't want to be too early. The earlier you spawn, the more you put you and your offspring at risk of torrential floods, which might potentially wipe out your entire nest of fertilized embryos. And you might also worry about predators. If your offspring emerge too early in the spring and there's no food but a suite of hungry predators, they might get chomped and none of them will survive. So to take a look at this, I took the date that each coho salmon migrated up through the fish ladder, and I point out that they're migrating basically over a four-month period from early October all the way through the end of January. So there's considerable scope for a difference in reproductive success based on migration date. And then I used a graphing technique that basically puts a smooth curve through all the points of the number of offspring produced. So the number of offspring produced is now on the y-axis. We've got the estimated breeding date on the x-axis. And we see something that's pretty interesting. So in 2003, it was good to be early. The most successful fish were those that entered right off the bat. In 2004 and 2005, it was good to spawn in the middle part of the run. So we see the peak or most successful spawning happening here in the middle for 2004 in both sexes. Now, this isn't that surprising. Considering that these fish are spawning over 4 months in an environment that's really variable. We know that coastal rivers where coho salmon spawn are usually, the flows are up and down, and that really creates a variable environment. So in any given year, the optimum spawn date is unpredictable, and it's going to vary from year to year. And perhaps the population as a whole spreads out its spawning over this four-month period, because in any one year, you're not really sure when the optimum spawning date is going to be. Okay, so I'm going to just summarize my results, and I'm going to conclude by talking about this project in the context of dams and conservation. So, again, under a policy of natural colonization, or simply letting the fish access this habitat on their own, both Chinook salmon and coho salmon accessed this new habitat right when it became available from the very first generation. So the Chinook salmon population still looks like it's mostly composed on strays from the lower river, although it's moving towards becoming self-sustaining. The coho salmon population is self-sustaining, and the run is dominated by recruits from a previous year's spawning season. So we saw great variation in the individual reproductive success, particularly of the males, in which there was more variation than the females. There was some, but definitely not conclusive, evidence that the Chinook hatchery males were less productive than the natural origin males, and there was really no consistent pattern at all for the females. We found that breeding date had a strong but variable influence on coho salmon reproductive success. So I just want to finish by talking about this work in the context of conservation. And this map compiled here by the Army Corps of Engineers shows all the dams greater than 50 feet in height in our region. And some of these dams are fitted with fish passage structures, just like Landsberg Dam, where I've done my work. But many of them are not. And I think that nobody would argue with me when I say that dams have permanently altered the landscape of salmon habitat in our area. And it's not just dams. There's a number of areas that are off limits to migratory fish, from improper road crossings, basically culverts that are inaccessible to migratory fish. A recent study estimated that in Washington State alone, several thousand kilometers of habitat that was formerly inaccessible, or formerly was accessible to migratory fish, is now off limits based on road crossings like this. But fortunately, I think this concept of restoring access to lost habitat is really gaining momentum as a means of salmon conservation. So these situations here, so Condit Dam and Glides Canyon Dam, so Condit Dam on the White Salmon River, Glides Canyon Dam on the Elwha River are slated for removal in the coming years, and Pelton Dam on the Deschutes is planned to be fitted with fish passage structures. So this idea that we can restore access to habitat is really gaining momentum as a means of bolstering our salmon populations. And we're really hoping that some of the research we're doing here at the university, as well as our collaborators at NOAA Fisheries and also the City of Seattle, really have some lessons to learn or something to offer in terms of how to manage populations as they expand into these new habitats. And I would say probably the most significant lesson we've learned so far is that simply opening the door for the fish and allowing them to recolonize on their own has worked. So in the Cedar River, we really had two things going for us. We had that nearby source population of both Chinook and coho salmon immediately below the dam. We also had relatively high quality habitat above the dam. So it seems in situations like these, perhaps the best policy would simply be to open the door and let the salmon colonize on their own and move towards establishing a self-sustaining population. And I think this will really give the salmon the best chance of adapting to and thriving in their new habitat. Okay, I want to just end again by acknowledging those that have helped me out a great deal in my research, in particular Paul Folds and John McDowell with the City of Seattle, who have done all the sampling of the adults that I've talked about today. I've had a number of people help me in the lab, but in particular, Will and Todd have given me a lot of help. The City of Seattle, a number of folks have helped me with logistics and critique a lot of my ideas as I move forward. My advisor, Tom Quinn, and my lab mates have also given me a number of great ideas and how to present these data and how to communicate them. And finally, Seattle Public Utilities, Washington Sea Grant, and the H. Mason Keeler Foundation for funding support. And thank you for listening.
Yeah, the question was, in the removal of the Elwha Dam, is there going to be some focused transplanting and hatchery supplementation? And there might be some people in the audience that would know more than I. My understanding is that the reach between the dams, there will be some supplementation, but they're going to do it in a measured and focused way to really try to learn if that approach is successful. But there are also going to be large stretches of the river in which there's going to be no supplementation. Now, the details on the specifics of that. How do I feel about that? I think it certainly depends a lot on the folks are concerned about there is that the habitat between the dams is going to take some time to develop. It's not the same situation that we have here where you've basically got intact and high-quality habitat from the get-go, and that because there's so much sediment that's accumulated that potentially folks are impatient and want to kickstart the population. Now, I'm not too keen on the idea, but I understand that there's a number of different opinions about how to do these things, and I think if it is going to happen, I want to make sure it's done in a scientific and way so that we can actually learn whether or not it worked or not.
Do you think that the coho were more successful in establishing their population than the Chinook because of the longer resident time for juvenile and the hunting versus the adult population?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that I think in terms of the time scale, I think probably a lot of it has to do with the age of maturity, that they're maturing earlier in time. So just at this snapshot, 6 years out, they've had a full generation, whereas the Chinook have not. But some of the work that our collaborators at NOAA Fisheries have shown is that the densities of resident fish, so trout and sculpin, in the area above the dam are actually quite low, and that the coho salmon that inhabit that area for a full year have actually done really well and grown quite remarkably. And so that because there's very little competition for the youngsters as they rear in the freshwater, it seems likely that that might have something to do with their the success they've had in establishing the self-sustaining population. Yeah.
How do trends that you've seen in your study compare to other rivers or streams in this watershed?
That's a great question. I really like that table that I showed with the population productivity to compare that to some data from nearby rivers, basically, in central Puget Sound. The idea being to see if are we seeing more productivity, less productivity? Are the trends kind of driven by regional processes, or is there something different going on in this area, the Cedar River? And I just haven't done that yet. Basically, looking to find the right source of data, the right comparison to make, but that would really be something I'd like to include in my dissertation. One more? Go ahead.
So your strays, you have a bunch of strays. Where else could they be coming from? Or is there habitat destruction and they're moving into these streams?
That's a good question. So one of my colleagues that works for the city of Seattle does surveys for Chinook salmon in the lower river. And so he looks for those nests. And so he uses that as kind of in addition to the counting fish, kind of as a metric to estimate the population in the lower river. And so in 2007, there was actually, if you remember, a really large run that came up through the fish ladder. And it looked like not only was there more fish that went up the fish ladder, it was actually a higher proportion of the whole river. So because the run was so big, there's probably densities were kind of getting squeezed in the lower river. And that potentially encouraged more fish to move into the habitat above the dam. So it probably has something to do with the density and abundance of the source population. And once that kind of reaches some carrying capacity or some limit where fish are having trouble establishing territories, they might be more encouraged to move to further off distances. Now, I can't say for sure, those fish that I'm assigning no parents to, I can't really say for sure exactly where they came from. I mean, it seems likely that most of them are coming from the lower river. But moving forward, there's a potential to, maybe do some more detailed genetic analysis to look and see, if the genotypes of the strays are coming from different sources, if they're all kind of the same source. That's something I've thought about but haven't really pursued at this point.
Any last questions?
Yeah.
Why did you do breeding day for coho and hatchery success for chinook instead of the other way around?
Well, for coho, there weren't very many hatchery fish, so there's really not much of a comparison there. I chose to do... We actually had... another trait in coho salmon, body length. So all the fish were measured for see how big they were as they went into the river. And I chose breeding date just because it kind of showed that interesting pattern of difference between the years. Now, the Chinook stuff I basically did last week, and I was really interested in the hatchery natural origin question, so I kind of zoomed in on that first. But in principle, I can do the exact same thing I did with the coho, the breeding date, and actually the body size as well. So it's basically what I've done at this point. Yep. We did not, we have tagged a number of the adult coho, so actually my master's thesis we gave radio transmitters to a lot of the coho and to try to track the very first 2 years, 2003 and 2004, to see how much they move around and where they eventually spawned. We basically found that most of the fish spawn in the coho at least, in the 6 to 7 kilometers immediately upstream of the dam. And then in terms of the movements, there was actually an interesting result in that the males were really mobile. They were moving all over the place, whereas the females were much more deliberate in their movements. So the females basically swam upstream slowly, established their nest site, and just kind of stayed there, whereas the males were kind of zooming all over the watershed looking for mates, basically. We've also done some tagging studies with the juvenile salmon, so capturing coho in the stream, while they're rearing during the summer, and then looking to see patterns of survival, which ones basically make it to the Ballard Locks, where there's a detector for the tag. And that's the work of a colleague of mine at NOAA Fisheries. To answer your question?
Yeah. Great. Well, let's...